All right, welcome. This is episode 647 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, we're going to be finishing the series on the 386. This is going to be series 9. All right. So we're going to pick up from question 77. A 58-year-old man comes to the office because of a lesion on his lower lip that developed 9 months ago. He has not seen a physician during the past 5 years and says, "My wife made me come to see you today. Physical examination of the lips discloses the findings shown in the photograph. The lower lip is fixed to the anterior aspect of the mandible. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis?" Right? So we see this lesion, right? Looks like an ulcer. It's kind of around the lower lip, right? This looks like cancer, right? This is probably going to be squamous cell skin cancer, right? So we're going to go with option E. It can't be option A, basal cell cancer, because we're not seeing like those telangiectasias and things like that that we see with basal cell cancer. And then this is not a keratoacanthoma. A keratoacanthoma typically is going to be a raised lesion with a central crater, right? So it's like a raised lesion with a central crater. In fact, many times it's regarded as a kind of squamous cell cancer. So that's wrong. Leukoplakia, remember, we tend to find that in immunocompromised patients, HIV patients. It will be a lesion that is on the lateral tongue or on the tongue, and it doesn't scrape off with a tongue depressor, unlike candida, right? And then melanoma tends to be a flat lesion, right? So the right answer is going to be option E. Now, a 10-year-old boy, so 78, a 10-year-old boy is brought to the ED by his father because of left flank pain and tenderness. About 4 hours ago, the boy was hit hard on the abdomen during a karate match. Abdominal CT scan shows a large splenic tear. In the pediatric intensive care unit, his blood pressure is stabilized and his hematocrit is 45%. Which of the following is the most appropriate immediate step? Option E says, let's look at this, right? So this child has a splenic tear, right? A splenic laceration. But now his blood pressure has stabilized. His hematocrit is fine. So what should you do? Option E says continue pulse and blood pressure monitoring. So this child is pretty stable. So I'm going to go with that option. Because the thing is, see, if you can avoid removing somebody's spleen, try everything you can to not remove it. Because the spleen has a very robust immune function, right? So if you can avoid removing a person's spleen, especially if the person is stable. If a person has suffered splenic injury and they're stable, try not to remove their spleen. So I'm going to go with option A. Option B says do ciliotomy and splenectomy. No. This child is stable. The hematocrit is fine. Just watch him. So that's wrong. Option C says order diagnostic abdominal paracentesis. Again, we do paracentesis when we're worried about a person having like spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. You know, so say for example, they have like ascites, right? But this child does not have ascites. And then option D says order intravenous urography. Well, intravenous urography is something you use to analyze the kidneys, the ureters, the bladder, the urinary system. It's like a CT scan, right? Or an X-ray. It's basically a radiograph with contrast of the urinary system. This person doesn't seem to have any urinary system troubles. And then order radionuclide scan of the spleen. You don't really need to do that, right? Radionuclide scans on the USMLEs tend to be like RIU scans for the thyroid, or you can do a radionuclide scan, you know, for Meckel's diverticulum, or you can do a radionuclide scan for, so I've talked about thyroid disease, Meckel's diverticulum, also for some cardiac stress tests, right? Like the technetium tests. Yes, those are radionuclide scans. All right. So we're going to go to question 79. A 42-year-old woman with a history of MS comes to the office because she had a sudden loss of vision in one eye, in the right eye, right? She has no history of diplopia. External ocular movements are normal, but fundoscopic examination shows pallor of the optic disc. This patient's condition is most likely a result of demyelination of which of the following, right? So we see painless sudden onset vision loss in a person that has multiple sclerosis, right? This is going to be optic neuritis. It's a cranial 2 problem. It's a cranial 2 problem, right? So the problem is an optic nerve problem. Your optic nerve is cranial 2. So the right answer is going to be C. Option A, the MLF, the medial longitudinal fasciculus, right? That's what causes intranuclear ophthalmoplegia. When you have intranuclear ophthalmoplegia, you're going to have an adduction, ADD auction nystagmus on horizontal conjugate gaze, right? You're not going to have vision loss, right? So this is not an MLF problem, right? Oculomotor nerve, that's wrong, right? That's cranial nerve 3, right? Remember, your oculomotor nerve is derived from the peripheral nervous system. It's not derived from the CNS. The only cranial nerve that's derived from the central nervous system is cranial 2, is the optic nerve. So it's the only cranial nerve that is generally affected in multiple sclerosis, right? So it's not the oculomotor nerve. Remember, the optic nerve is an outgrowth of the diencephalon, but every other cranial nerve is derived from the neural crest. But cranial 2 is derived from the diencephalon, is derived from neural tube. It's not a factoid many resources talk about, but it's actually pretty high yield to know for your exams. And then the trigeminal nerve, that's wrong, right? It's not going to cause vision problems. Option E, visual cortex. That's going to be like cortical blindness. That's not what's going on here, right? So we're going to go to question number 80. We're going to go to question 80, right? So a 28-year-old woman who is known to be HIV positive comes to the ED because of a one-week history of increasing headaches, right-sided weakness, and disorientation. A generalized tonic-clonic seizure occurs shortly after admission. Following the seizure, vital signs are normal. There is no nuchal rigidity. Fundoscopic examination shows papilledema. There is also right hemiparesis and aphasia. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis, right? So we see a person that has HIV, and this person seems to have a increased intracranial pressures, right? Increased intracranial pressures. This doesn't look like meningitis, right? This person doesn't have nuchal rigidity. This person seems to have increased ICP, right? So the person probably has some kind of space-occupying lesion in the brain, right? Space-occupying lesions in the brain should make you think of a few things, right? Like what? Toxoplasmosis. Or what? A primary CNS lymphoma, right? So the thing is, this space-occupying lesion is kind of concerning, right? It's probably something that is like a mass or ring-enhancing lesion or whatever. So I'm going to go for toxoplasmosis here. I'm going to go with option D, right? Meningioma, right, is not, it's going to be more of a chronic mass, right? And it doesn't usually present with signs of increased ICP. Meningococcal meningitis, again, the person is going to have fever. The person is going to have, you know, very high fevers. They're going to have nuchal rigidity. We don't see that here. On neurosyphilis, right, we're going to see things like tabes dorsalis, right? We don't see that here. We don't see tabes dorsalis. We don't see many of those signs of neurosyphilis. So that's wrong, right? Tuberculosis meningitis, again, if you have meningitis, you have nuchal rigidity, you have high fevers, you have you will have abnormal vital signs. Meningitis is pretty deadly, so you're going to have abnormal vital signs, right? So the answer is going to be option D, right? And remember, we're going to treat that with pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine, right? And we're going to give the person a leucovorin as well so they don't develop a bone marrow suppression. All right, so question 81 says, a five-year-old girl with a lumbar myelomeningocele is brought to the... And remember, pyrimethamine, sulfadiazine, those are folate synthesis inhibitors, right? Again, please don't mess this up. The way we treat toxoplasmosis is with pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine, okay? The way we treat it, but the way we prophylax against it, right, if your CD4 count is under 100, is with trimethoprim sulfa methoxazole. All right. So question 81, a five-year-old girl is with a lumbar myelomeningocele is brought to the office by her mother for a periodic health evaluation. The girl has little motor function and no sensation below the waist. She has a neurogenic bladder requiring intermittent catheterization. And she also requires daily suppositories to aid in bowel movements. She does not have hydrocephalus, but can walk only with the aid of braces and crutches. I am pleased with how well she's doing, says the mother, but I am so worried about what might happen to her later on. Which of the following is the most likely late complication in this patient? Right? So think about this. This person has a myelomeningocele, right? So this person has bladder dysfunction, right? When you have bladder dysfunction, think about it, you pretty much have like a functional obstruction, a functional obstructive uropathy, right? That obstructive uropathy over time is going to cause problems with renal failure, right? It's going to cause problems with renal failure, right? Because you have obstruction, right? So you have like these increased pressures within your collecting system and whatnot that can ultimately lead to renal failure. Again, I know you may have never heard of this before, but it doesn't mean you cannot get this right, right? All you literally need to do is ask yourself, what's the answer that relates to what the question is talking about? The question clearly tells you that, wait, this person requires daily suppositories. The question tells you that the person has a neurogenic bladder, right? So it has to be linked to one of those things, right? So carcinoma of the bladder is wrong, right? Remember, the biggest risk factor for bladder cancer is smoking. COPD is wrong. She's not a smoker. Corpomonale is wrong, right? Remember, corpomonale typically happens when people have, it's basically like right heart failure because of a pulmonary cause, right? It's typically right heart failure because of a pulmonary cause, right? Heart failure because of a pulmonary cause, right? This person doesn't have like cystic fibrosis or anything like that, right? So that's not what's going on here. All right. And then end-stage renal disease is the correct answer. Option E says osteomyelitis of the femoral head. No, right? We tend to find that in people that have like Cushing syndrome, for example, right? Or people that are taking steroids. That's osteonecrosis of the femoral head. So osteomyelitis of the femoral head, osteomyelitis is an actual infection. No, that's not what's going on. This person, there's no reason to develop that. So please, whenever people have steroid excess, they develop osteonecrosis of the femoral head. Osteonecrosis of the femoral head. Please keep that in mind. All right, so a 26-year-old man is brought to the ED by his family because he has been telling them that he's being followed by gangsters and that they are going to kill him. The family states that he has a history of drug abuse. His temperature is 100. Pulse is 110, right? So he's tachycardic, right? He's very hypertensive. His blood pressure is 160 over 95. His pupils are dilated. The remainder of the physical exam discloses no abnormalities. Which of the following drugs most likely caused this reaction? So we see this person has papillary mydriasis, right? So he's probably in a sympathetic state. We see the blood pressure is really, really high, right? This is probably going to be cocaine, right? Remember, cocaine increases the amount of catecholamines you have at adrenergic synapses, right? So the answer has to be B, right? This cannot be alcohol, right? Alcohol, you know, you have like disinhibited behavior and things like that. It's not going to cause your blood pressure to rise. It's not going to cause papillary mydriasis. So that's wrong. Diazepam, right? It's a benzo. It's going to cause respiratory depression. It's going to cause respiratory depression, right? Heroin, right, is an opioid, right? So it's going to cause respiratory depression and papillary meiosis. We don't see that here, right? Methaqualone, it's actually kind of it's not a barbiturate, but it works just like a barbiturate. It modulates GABA receptors. You know, back in the day, believe it or not, this stuff was actually a prescription. It was called a Quaaludes, but they banned it because it has a pretty high abuse potential. Kind of works like a barbiturate. It modulates the GABA A receptor. So that's wrong, right? So again, cocaine increases the amount of catecholamines at the adrenergic synapse. So that can cause you to have things like crazy high blood pressure because of alpha-1 mediated vasoconstriction. It can raise your heart rate, so you can become tachycardic because of beta-1 stimulation, right? It can cause you to have mydriasis because there's alpha-1 receptors in the eye as well, right? Another thing that can cause a similar presentation is methamphetamine, right? But there's a reason why they didn't put that as an answer as well. All right, so now question 83 says, several patients with hypertension whom you have treated for many years have recently had strokes. You are frustrated by this outcome and review the literature on the efficacy of antihypertensive treatments in preventing stroke. A large multi-center randomized trial shows that a particular antihypertensive medication lowers the 5-year risk for stroke, right? Lowers the 5-year risk for stroke from 8 per 1,000 patients to 6 per 1,000 patients, right? Providing a relative risk reduction of 25%. Based on this study, the number of patients with hypertension who must be treated to prevent one stroke is which of the following, right? So this question is asking about the number needed to treat. How many people do you need to give this antihypertensive to prevent one stroke? Well, remember, for you to calculate to calculate number needed to treat first, you need to find the absolute risk reduction and then take the inverse of it. Find the absolute risk reduction and then take the inverse, right? And the absolute risk reduction is a difference in risk, right? So it's like 8 per 1,000 minus 6 per 1,000. That's 2 per 1,000. Right? That's the absolute risk reduction. And then just flip it. Take the inverse. 1,000 divided by 2 is 500, right? So the NNT is 500. This drug has basically no clinical significance, right? No clinical significance. The NNT is 500, right? Like literally to prevent one stroke, 500 people have to get this drug. This drug has no clinical significance, right? So remember, NNT is a very good way to gauge clinical significance on the USMLE exams, right? All right. And also in the real world. Right now, question 84 and 85, a 48-year-old Native American construction worker who sustained a comminuted fracture of his left tibia and fibula 4 months ago is transferred from the rehabilitation facility to the ED because of a 3-hour history of dyspnea and chest pain. Whoa. During the past 3 months since sustaining the fracture, he has resided in the rehabilitation facility with his left lower extremity fully mobilized. That's not good. He now describes an aching discomfort over the right superior anterior chest and the right scapula posteriorly. That's not good. Family history is strongly positive for heart disease. All right. So we see a person that is like fully mobilized, right, for weeks, Come on, right? This sounds an awful lot like a PE. All right, so let's look at 84. It says, in questioning the patient further, an important point in the history would be the relationship of the pain to which of the following? A says change of position. B says deep breathing. C says eating. D says swallowing. E says walking, right? Remember, one common presentation you may find in people that have PEs, pulmonary embolus, is pleuritic chest pain. It's pleuritic chest pain, right? So I'm going to go with option B for this, right? Change of position, that's probably going to be more pericarditis, right? Gets worse when you lay back, when you're supine, gets better when you lean forward, right? Eating, that's probably going to be some kind of esophageal problem. Swallowing, probably some kind of esophageal problem. Walking, maybe like angina or something like that, right? So now the presence, question 85 says, the presence of a right pleural effusion, right pleural friction rub in this patient will suggest which of the following, right? So pleural friction rub, right? Again, this is probably a PE, right? Probably a PE, right? So again, I'm not going to pick pericarditis, right? Pericarditis is, again, gets worse when you lay back, better when you lean forward. Not going to be pneumonia, right? Pneumonia is it's going to cause chest pain, but you're going to have fever and all these things, right? Pneumothorax, you're going to have decreased breath sounds. You're going to have decreased breath sounds and things like that. And pneumothorax is pretty sudden, right? PE with infarction. Yeah, I'm going to pick option D, right? Because remember, when you have infarction, infarction hurts, right? It's just kind of like when a person has an MI, their chest hurts, right? So when there's an infarction, it's going to hurt in your pleura, right? So option E says PE without infarction. That's probably not as accurate. So I'm going to go with option D for this one. All right, so last question of the free 86. Woohoo! A 68-year-old woman who underwent flexible sigmoidoscopy 6 hours ago in the office as part of routine screening returns to the office because of left lower quadrant abdominal pain, fever, nausea, and vomiting. Uh-oh, that's not good. Now, during the procedure, a 3-centimeter polyp was found in the sigmoid colon and was removed. Vital signs are temperature of 100.6, so that's a fever, so 38.1 degrees Celsius. She's tachycardic, she's tachypneic, her blood pressure is 120 over 60. Abdominal examination discloses bowel sounds and tenderness and guarding. Whoa, in the left lower quadrant, right? So those are signs of peritonitis. Rectal examination shows no stool and tenderness only superiorly. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step, right? This person has signs of peritonitis. That's an indication for exploratory laparotomy, right? So let's look for the XLAP answer. Option A says, obtain angiography to rule out intestinal ischemia. That's not XLAP. That's wrong. Option B says, obtain immediate consultation with a surgeon. Yeah, that's the person that can do XLAP for you. I'm going to go with option B. Option C says, pass a soft rubber rectal tube under fluoroscopy. When you have peritonitis, you've probably ruptured something. Do you think it's a good idea to pass a tube into a person where something has ruptured? That's not a smart idea. I'm not going to do that. Option D says, repeat the flexible sigmoidoscopy to evaluate the operative site. No. Again, when a person has potentially ruptured their bowel, you don't introduce tubes into the bowel because that can cause like very significant infection and death. Option E says, start hydrocortisone intravenously to decrease any inflammatory response. No, don't do that, right? Go and do exploratory laparotomy. All right, so that's it. Again, if you love the way I teach, again, if you notice, I explain pathophysiology. I show you how things present on the exams. I make integrations, right? Many people have taken my classes and done extremely well on their exams. I really put everything I can into truly helping you understand the content, into truly helping you understand the material, right? And many people have run through my courses and done extremely well on their tests. So if you're interested, I have a last minute review for step 2, step 3 taking place today. And starting tomorrow, I have a 20-hour comprehensive step 2, step 3 review. And then in the month of June, first 2 weeks, I have a 50-hour step 2, step 3 class. And I also have a series of other classes I'm going to be teaching in the month of May. So if you're interested, shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams and med school exams, and I help with ERAS applications, personal statements, mock interviews, and rec letters. And then, these podcasts are on Apple, Google, and Spotify, so check those out. I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos, where I post the videos that I make. And then, I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Divine Intervention lifelessons.com. Many of you that listen to this podcast know I'm a Christ follower, right? So every week I post one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. Again, I think you listen to these podcasts, you find them to be helpful. Share with your friends and your colleagues, and I wish you all the best on your exams. Have a wonderful day. Have a wonderful week. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.